Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. This we continue discussing litigation related to COVID-19 by attorneys who've been bringing lawsuits and in this case had great success. We are speaking with Catherine Henry, an attorney in private practice in the state of Michigan and the founder of Restore Freedom, who has now argued and won before the Michigan Supreme Court. Catherine, congratulations.
Thank you, but I do need to clarify. All of my work so far with the Michigan Supreme Court on these COVID-19 cases has been as an amicus attorney. So
right.
I'm not the lead attorney representing any of the plaintiffs involved.
Right. Let's start with you. Your process by which you first became interested in what the governor had done, what was happening in Michigan, and decided to really take time from a private practice. And I know you're a busy mother. To really do something about it.
Yes. So I knew that the evening of Thursday, March 12th at 11:15 p.m. when the governor came on and did her press conference and said that she was shutting down schools for 3 weeks, that it was just the beginning. It was just the beginning of something that was going to go far beyond school and far beyond just impacting children for a few weeks. It was going to be long lasting and it was going to have devastating effects all across the state. A lot of people just thought it was no big deal right from the beginning, but I did not. I was very upset. So right from then I had a keen interest and was paying attention. By the first week of April, first couple days of April, we got wind that the legislature was getting ready to vote to approve an extension for our state of emergency that had been declared by our governor. And I instinctively went into fight or flight mode. I don't typically do the flight version of that. So I took to the radio and took to Facebook and other avenues of social media and was trying to educate all of us around Michigan on what the law says, what the Constitution says, and how to put the pressure on the legislature to not vote to have an extension. Unfortunately, that didn't work, and the legislature voted to give her another 23 days, bringing her time to April 30th. I then participated in a rally on the Capitol steps that day and was able to speak essentially in front of the world about how it was unconstitutional and quite frankly the science and the medicine didn't follow what
now,
she was saying.
Let me just interrupt you for a second. When you say unconstitutional, you mean both under the U.S. Constitution and the Michigan Constitution?
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
And so we were able to put the pressure on the legislature that day. And you know, it's often referred to as when the armed men stormed the Capitol. That's not at all what happened. I was there, and it was actually with the state police. Other than the fact they unconstitutionally kept us out of the session of legislature in direct violation of our state constitution. But aside from that, the conversations with the law enforcement that day were actually very pleasant and kind. When I walked in, I saw they were taking temperatures and I felt that was a huge violation of my right to privacy. So I asked if they would kindly allow me to proceed into the building without having my temperature checked or any of that stuff happening. And they said, yes, that would be fine. And I walked in and said, okay, thanks. Have a great day. That's the storming of the Capitol that happened. And so at any rate, from then on, it was on. I went home that night, and I mean, we had thousands of people that were physically there, and then we had tens of thousands more, if not more than that, that were watching live on all the Facebook Live feeds and things.
Remember,
like that.
We posted a lot of the videos that got posted on social media of what happened, and it looked like a wonderful group of people and a wonderful crowd.
It was, especially the aftermath in the legislature while we were trying to get into the House chambers. Mm-hmm. I stood right at the front of it all when I saw things might get ugly. It did not. But, you know, we had some guys and testosterone and tempers and things. It can lead to some bad situations. I'm a wife and I'm a mother of a teenage boy. And so I understand men a little bit. And so I am also a trained mediator, and I have been a mediator for over a decade. So I wanted to be able to offer assistance and try to bring calm in that storm. And even though law enforcement in that situation was in the wrong, they didn't have the right to do what they were doing. So I was able to actually be able to explain the bills that were being voted on and the executive orders that were being implicated by those votes, and whether we wanted them to vote yes or no in general. I just wanted to at least give the information to the people. And it was amazing because they were inside, we're in a hallway and there's stairways. And so it's not like it was this big auditorium with a lot of room. We were packed in there like sardines. And it was phenomenal because we had a lot of people that were, you know, just, again, no one knew who I was. No one knew necessarily that I was even an attorney before I started to speak. But there were people that knew I had spoken outside, and they were trying to quiet down this group of, I don't know how many were in there, 300-400 people, all in the hallway there. And when they knew that I was trying to help and try to offer information, it was amazing. You could hear a pin drop. Right. Every time that I had new information to offer, the crowd would quiet down, and long after the legislature, that the House anyway, left for the day, they left, and the people stayed and waited because they wanted information on the bill that had been passed, Senate Bill 858. It was quite lengthy, and nobody was given any of it ahead of time because it had changed drastically from when they first got the bill to when they then modified it and sent it back over to the Senate. And so it was amazing to have hundreds of people just sitting around continuing to wait to get the information that they were so hungry for. And that's what's continued to happen. So, you know, we, that day, one of the votes that did happen was that the legislature voted to, approve a lawsuit against the governor for violating, if she were to continue, with the executive orders. And I posted on my page, I'm not very much, social media savvy. I hate social media. I think it's evil. I like real people. And so I did post on my Facebook page, though. I think all I said, it was a sentence or two. It just said, you know, we're free. The governor's orders are over. You know, there's no more legal authority, and there never was constitutional authority. So we're done. It's it.
Right.
And I was flooded. I woke up the next morning within, you know, 8 hours of having posted that. And I, from then on, I've had thousands of notifications coming in on Facebook and Twitter and all my other, you know, my email and my phone have been just blown up. And so it's been an interesting journey.
Well, I can imagine. I just have to underscore this. If the legislature has refused to authorize, why wouldn't you think it was game over? That is astonishing. I mean, if I were you, I would have been absolutely stunned when the governor went forward with more. Well, was it another executive order? I don't know the specifics of what she went forward with.
So what she did was she said, well, the law says that I have to terminate it. So in one order, she terminated the executive order. The very next, the state of emergency, excuse me, the next executive order, she continued the state of emergency that was just terminated. And then the next order, she began the state of emergency that she had just continued that had just been terminated. It's preposterous. The whole, like, it doesn't even make common sense.
Let me just throw in another thing. The governor is a former prosecutor and a trained attorney. So she knows better. She took an oath of office related to the constitutions, and with her experience and background, she knows those documents. So she knew what she was doing was not legal.
Absolutely. She's taken at least three oaths of office that I'm aware of, because she's a licensed attorney here in the state of Michigan and had to take an oath to uphold the U.S. and Michigan constitutions in order to be licensed.
Right.
She was a senator, and in that position, she took an oath of office, which of course is required under Article 11, Section 1 of our state constitution, but also Article 6 of the United States Constitution to uphold the U.S. Right. and Michigan constitutions. And then she's our governor. So she took the same oath of office again to take that position. So it's something that for how many times she's taken the oath of office, she should certainly have figured out how to read those documents. Absolutely.
Right. Okay. So what happened next?
It's just been a crazy whirlwind of things. She ended up issuing, last I saw, I don't know if she's tried to squeeze in anymore, 192 executive orders in the year 2020.
Wow.
So it's absurd. So in all governors between 1993 and 2019, which includes her, all governors between that period of time, the total amount of executive orders issued was always much higher by Democrat governors, by the way. But if you look at all of them in that period of time, I believe that's 26 years. I'm an attorney, not a mathematician, but that was 605 executive orders. And yet this year alone, she's issued 192.
That's unbelievable.
It's crazy. And in fact, of the 605, only 25 of them related to a state of emergency mm-hmm. in that 26-year period of time. So less than one a year, where she issued 192. Now, I will say, at my last count, of the 192 of those, 11 of those were based on things not related to COVID-19. They were... Right. From what I can tell, they were actually constitutional because our state constitution, Article 3, Section 2, allows a governor to, Article 5, Section 2, allows a governor to issue executive orders for the purpose of reorganizing the executive branch, so long as those orders are then presented to the legislature and they're given 60 days to essentially veto or disapprove of that reorganization.
Right.
So I believe 11 of those were that, but I mean, so 181 out of 192, that's just, it's a lot. So, go ahead.
So the lawsuits then began?
Yes, I believe the lawsuits actually began even before that. Lawsuits started, in April, both in federal and state court against her.
So you had some doctor's offices. Were the doctor's offices or hospitals brought litigation, and then the legislature brought litigation.
Yeah, so there are three doctor's offices and one patient that joined together as plaintiffs to sue the governor, the attorney general, Dana Nessel, and the director of the Department of Health and Human Services for Michigan, Robert Gordon. And that was done in federal district court. And what the federal district court judge said was, well, if I don't have to issue this, if I don't have to make a decision based on federal constitutional principles or federal statutes, and I can just simply rely on it, resolving this case in terms of the state constitution or state statute issues, then I'm just going to do that instead, which they do that because they want to, you know, ensure a separation of powers and they're not unnecessarily trampling over things that are done right. by other branches of government. But quite right. frankly, if a governor is violating the U.S. Constitution, I don't care what other things are there. They should make it plainly clear to the people of the United States, this governor, by doing this, is violating the U.S. Constitution. So she right. can't do that anymore, and neither can any other governor.
Right.
But that's, you know, that's not part of the big government process here that we have these days. So essentially what they did is they had two questions that they want certified to the Michigan State Supreme Court. So the two questions were very, very limited in scope, very specific. The first one was whether the governor's executive orders violated after April 30th. Whether those orders violated either of our two statutes on point about emergency powers and the 1945 and 1976 law we so lovingly call them here in Michigan, or whether either of those two statutes violated our state constitution, specifically the separation of powers and non-delegation clauses of our state constitution.
So basically what part of this is, she proceeded without authority from the legislature. And what this is saying is you can't do that. You have to have authority from the legislature to do, to proceed. Now, does it also mean that even if she had authority from the legislature, it would still be in violation of the Michigan Constitution? Or is it just simply lacking the legislative authority?
Yeah, so the specific question, was whether it wasn't so much just with regard to the legislature, it was, did she violate those state statutes? Now, what the court determined on October 2nd was that, yes, she did violate the 1976 law after April 30th by continuing to issue the orders without the legislature's approval to extend any further. And so that's the very limited scope of that question.
Right.
They didn't address, in fact, so the second question is whether those two constitutional, whether those two statutes violated our state constitution.
Right.
And they found that the older of the two, the 1945 law, is entirely unconstitutional. No governor can ever use that again. Mm-hmm. And what they said, though, is that they were not even going to answer the question about whether the 1976 law violated the state constitution, because they had already determined that she had violated the 1976 law. And so essentially that made all of her orders illegal or unconstitutional on at least one basis. So they weren't going to answer the questions any further. Again, I understand why they're trying to do that. But again, to me, it's really not forgivable. It's a dereliction of duty, because when
they're trying to narrow the scope to the least, they're trying to leave the door as closed as possible by narrowing the scope. Now here's what's interesting. So then you told everybody to burn their masks, and to my shock and amazement, I mean, it was pretty shocking what the governor said next. And then what she did. So go ahead.
Yeah, so she actually didn't skip a beat. While I was doing my Facebook Live explanations to people about the executive orders and YouTube Lives, she was actually going on and doing press conferences saying that, well, the court said this, you know, that first of all, she blamed the legislature for suing her in the first place. And she blamed the courts for making this determination that, because of what the courts and the legislature have done, lots of people are going to die in Michigan. And so then she said, the court said she did everything perfectly legal. She followed the laws, but that the 1945 law was unconstitutional, meaning the legislature back in 1945 had no right to try to give the governor the power in the first place. Well, a few things about that. Number one, the way the law was passed in 1945 is that we had a legislature who did violate our state constitution by passing that bill, but then we had a governor in 1945 that signed that very same bill to make it become law.
Right.
So if she wants to blame the legislature, she's got to take the hit herself.
Right.
And so the other piece to that, where she was saying that the court said she did everything perfectly legal, that's a bald-faced lie, because what they said is she followed the wording of the 1945 unconstitutional law, but that she blatantly, a 7-0 opinion by the Michigan Supreme Court said she violated the 1976 law. 7 justices out of 7 said she violated the law, and she stood there in front of the Michigan people and said, nope, I didn't violate any laws. They said so. Not only that, but if a law is unconstitutional, such as the 1945 law, she has the duty to not uphold the laws. She took an oath of office to uphold the U.S. and Michigan constitutions. So she needs to know better. She should know better, and she took an oath to know better. So she never should have been using a law that was unconstitutional from the beginning. So there's just a huge variety of problems.
I just have to tell you one story. I served as the Assistant Secretary of Housing in the Bush administration at HUD. And we had a regional administrator get in a bit of a squabble with the secretary. And the secretary was complaining about a decision he'd made. And he said, but Mr. Secretary, I had to. That was the law. And the secretary blew up and he said, the law? I don't have to obey the law. I report to a higher moral authority. And when your governor said what she said, I thought, uh-oh, you know, here we are with the higher moral authority thing here. Because it was that, you know, the hubris with which she conducted herself to me was very shocking.
Well, so she also then, I started to say that she told the people of Michigan that her orders had at least 21 days to be in effect, which is a lie. Right from the beginning, it was a lie, because the way our court rules work is that individual orders or judgments as between parties are often held in abeyance for that period of time, because she would have that period of time to file a request or a motion for reconsideration or for a rehearing. And, but if she does file a motion for reconsideration, that specifically says nothing is held in abeyance during that 21 period of time, the 21 days. And so the precedential effect, as they were calling it, so the case law would be cemented, she said, after that period of time, but nothing in this precedent ever indicated that. In fact, it was very clear that the only cases on point, the only court rules on point, very clearly said that the second you have something in this situation where a law is deemed unconstitutional as it applies and affects 10 million people, the moment that the court clerk files that and date stamps it and makes it available to people, that's when it comes into effect. So her orders, her executive orders, were no more at that point. And again, she's a licensed attorney. She definitely should have known better. And if she didn't know better, then she shouldn't be a licensed attorney.
So I would like to point out that all the small business owners whose businesses have been shut down or whose enterprises have been shut down. And when I watched all the videos of the Michigan, you know, all the citizens coming to the Capitol, you know, a lot of them look like small business owners and small, you know, people who generate their own income. I would like to point, while their businesses were shut down, she continued to get her salary.
Yes. Yep. And while she shut down people like hairdressers, she tried to claim that one of her teenage daughters was doing her hair, dyeing her hair for her. Yeah, not happen, but whatever.
So she did file, I don't know if it's a motion to reconsider, but she did do another filing with the Supreme Court to try and...
She filed a motion to ask the court to wait at least 28 days before they put their decision into effect, because she said she wanted to be able to utilize, this is wonderful language. Let me see if I have it right here in front of me. She wanted to be able to, I don't have that... Nope, I don't have that particular one in front of me. She wanted to be able to utilize the other administrative tools of the executive branch, is what she was saying, so that she could take time to take all of her executive orders and put them into place under other kinds of orders through the executive branch, but not through executive orders. So she just wanted to be able to use different statutes to do the same thing.
Right.
And I thought, how ridiculous. They just said it violates the separation of powers for you to make these orders under this statute, and yet you're telling them you want to go do the same exact thing under a different statute. So, of course, the legislature filed a response to that. The Attorney General's office filed a response to that. The plaintiff, the original plaintiff in the case, filed a response, and then I filed a response as well. My response was a little bit more jam-packed, full of information, because they opened the door to talking about these other alternative methods, and these alternative methods are not constitutional under the same concepts that the original law was declared unconstitutional. But not only that, you have... quite frankly, our court actually talked about this concept, but the director of the Department of Health and Human Services, he comes into play here, because all along they've been trying to, he's been issuing, you know, he had issued, I think, three orders maybe throughout the summer, where it was reiterating her orders, and then adding on top of the misdemeanor penalties, he was adding civil infractions of up to $1,000, as well as business licensing sanctions that were done in a summary fashion with no hearing.
Oh my God, you're kidding.
Nope, that's been happening to our businesses all along. And so now the orders that we have in place, that she's put in place, the very same day she filed that motion with the court, which was it two Mondays? I think it was two Mondays ago now. She filed that at the same exact date that she had her director of the Department of Health and Human Services issue the next round of emergency orders under the public health code to require people to wear masks and to have certain businesses shut down or at very reduced capacities, to be able to stop people from gathering for any purpose, things like that. So this same director, in his press release, the day that he released, I want to say it was October 5th, he released the this first round of new orders. And in so doing, he, again, is showing utter contempt for the Michigan Supreme Court and for the legislature and talking about how they're just partisan and they don't know what they're doing and they're killing people. And then he talks about his time working as a clerk, I believe, in the United States Supreme Court and how, you know, the non-delegation doctrine, as he called it, is something that hasn't been used ever in the state of Michigan to invalidate a state law. And he claims that it has not been used at all in 85 years to invalidate a federal statute. And to that, I responded, and I quoted his whole statement to the Michigan Supreme Court, in case they happen to miss that one. And I let them know the reason why that's so important is because our state constitution, so the U.S. Constitution, we have a separation of powers, which the phrase separation of powers is nowhere in the United States Constitution. But what we see is that we have Article 1, Article 2, and Article 3 that separate out the executive, the legislative, executive, and judicial branches, respectively, with the powers that they have. So that's an obvious common sense separation of powers.
Right.
Then in our state constitution, we have Article 4, Section 1, Article 5, Section 1, and Article 6, Section 1 that do the same breakdown of powers. However, in addition to that, we have Article 3, Section 2, which was actually the main thrust of this, of a half of this certified question case in front of the Michigan Supreme Court anyway. And so that is the Michigan Constitution, Article 3, Section 2, has only two sentences, and they're beautiful. They say, separation of powers of government. Those words are actually in our state constitution. The powers of government are divided into three branches, legislative, executive, and judicial. And then the second sentence here says, no person exercising powers of one branch shall exercise powers properly belonging to another branch, except as expressly provided in this constitution. So although I would argue that common sense and the very words that are in our United States Constitution preclude any kind of delegation of power there because right. It's separated for a reason, that phrase is not in the United States Constitution. So it is properly called a notion or a doctrine in that sense. However, our state constitution, it is properly called a clause because it's actually words in our state constitution that prohibit such action outright. And so when he talked about that it's a notion, he said it's a doctrine, and then he downgraded it to a notion that has never been used to invalidate a law in the state of Michigan. To that I say, I'm disgusted at all of our judiciary to this point, because there are clearly several unconstitutional laws on the books because there's been a separation of powers issue there.
Right.
And these two are very specific ones that are at issue with that thing. But it's not a doctrine. It's a clause you have to follow.
Here's the thing. This is really simple. It's simple because the law requires the legislature to authorize. The legislature declined to authorize. The legislature is suing to say you can't do it without their authority, but you're just doing it. You know, it's kind of make up the law as you go.
Well, so that's the one element to it, right? That's the separation of powers kind of argument.
Right.
That in fact, the legislature had their own lawsuit that had been started in May.
Right.
And hadn't seen oral argument, and it will never see oral argument. In fact, I don't know if you've been made aware of this, but we had two orders come out from the Michigan Court of Appeal, excuse me, the Michigan Supreme Court on the 12th of October.
Right.
And so one was the response to the governor's request for the additional time. And they took it up very quickly. So they granted the request to hear the issue quickly under immediate consideration. But they said that this was only a two-sentence order. On the order of this court, the motion for immediate consideration is granted. The motion for to stay the precedential effect of the October 2nd opinion is considered and is denied.
Now, what was the vote on that, the denial?
This one is a 6-1.
Wow. So strong. Not unanimous, but very strong. Yeah.
Very strong. And so the interesting thing is the one justice on here, Justice Bernstein, that went against that, nowhere in here does he talk about that the Constitution allows for that to happen, or that there's any kind of actual authority that's given to the governor or even the court to allow that to happen. In fact, the only thing he talks about are some practical implications he's worried about with unemployment benefits. Well, quite frankly, regardless of whether something is deemed wise or not, or whether it seems like it's the prudent thing to do or not, or whether there's a different or better way to handle it, our Constitution is the supreme law of the land. And if you don't like it, that's too bad. Your job as a Supreme Court justice is not to rewrite the Constitution,
right,
nor as
exactly
a governor.
Right. So one of the points you made in your different discussions of the process as it's been going along, you provided some really frightening details of some of the things the Michigan state government was doing underneath these orders, like no FOIAs, no open meetings. Now, you know, that may sound like details, but when you realize what could be going on underneath the carpet while they're free to operate in secrecy, it's pretty frightening.
Yes, it is. And some of those things have actually continued to happen with reductions in the Open Meetings Act and the Freedom of Information Act. So again, these are all things that I knew were problems, right? I mean, before this even happened. And I've been trying to warn people publicly in mass quantities since at least April. In fact, in May, when I came out with the Restore Freedom Initiative constitutional amendment petition to amend the Michigan Constitution, it's not to change any kind of substance or form of the government. It's to try to address some of these very unconstitutional laws that are already on the books and that have remained on the books despite all these other provisions being in our Constitution. So to have that way to reel back in
right
those powers. And so people understand this is a government of the people, by the people, for the people, that in order to have true government accessibility and accountability, you have to be able to have open meetings. And a governor can't just change that with a stroke of a pen. You have to be able to have freedom of information, to have that flow of information. The constitutional amendment actually goes a step further, and it requires governments to operate their websites to provide all kinds of information for the people in the state of Michigan without even having to make a request. Because quite frankly, we shouldn't have to request the kind of information that's out there and allow them to have 5, 10, 15 days to make all these denials and play these games. So there's a lot more concerning things that are happening with regard to
one of the reasons that really rang a bell for me is what I saw in the federal government in the federal credit programs is when you could declare an emergency or a disaster, many of the financial controls would be lifted and the money would start to fly in very dangerously political ways. And if you had secrecy protecting it, then it would quickly go out of control. And yes. So, you know, the invitation for shenanigans, particularly in a highly politicized environment in a campaign year, is frightening.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're seeing a lot of different implications all the way around in that regard. So
right.
Just looking
now, tell
at-
me. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Keep going.
Well, I was just going to say that we're seeing, so for example, we have our Michigan director of the Department of Health and Human Services who debuted more prominently on October 5th with these additional orders. And he's continuing to issue more and more orders supposedly under the public health code here in Michigan. But the interesting thing is that the public health code that he's using, that particular statute 333.2253, is not very long.
Right.
And yet it seems that none of our government officials have read it, because it allows the director of the Department of Health and Human Services to do three things. One is to enforce health laws that are already on the books. Let's pick the mask issue, for example. There's no law on the books that says we have to wear masks, so that doesn't apply. He can do issue orders to ensure continuation of essential public health services. Well, a service is something that you're offering for the benefit of somebody else that they can right. choose to decline.
Right.
And so if they want to offer masks for people to use, if they want to offer hand sanitizer, if they want to offer educational opportunities to hear about COVID-19 and ways to boost your immune system or whatever, those would be allowed. But to require things of us is not acceptable. And quite frankly, it's to ensure the continuation of essential public health services. So instead, what did our governor do so far is that she had shut down things so that we did not have programs like AA. You were allowed to have alcohol, the liquor stores were allowed to stay open, but you were not allowed to go to an AA meeting. You right. were allowed to go get pot, but you were not allowed to go to an NA meeting.
Right.
You were allowed to have an abortion, but you were not allowed to have a hip replacement. And then right. You weren't allowed to receive any kind of spiritual guidance or support or counseling services to deal with the ramifications of any of that. So essential public health services should entail anger management and counseling services and all those mental health components. Especially, even the World Health Organization recognizes that when entire economies are essentially shut down, the instances of domestic violence, of self-harm, of child abuse and neglect skyrocket.
Right.
And a lot of them are not going to even be reported, because people like mandated reporters are kept away from the very people that they're there to try to protect by the mandated reporting laws. So those essential services are precluded. So the only other thing, the third thing that is allowed by the statute that he's using, is to prohibit the gathering of people for any purpose. So technically, he can, you know, stop people from being in restaurants or reduce the amount of people that are in stores or restaurants or things like that, but can't require masks from that at right. all, or any of those other provisions. But then let's just look at the common sense element. Prohibit the gathering of people for any purpose. I'm pretty sure that Article 1, Section 3 and Article 1, Section 4 of our state constitution expressly say no, not a thing. The same as our First Amendment to the United States Constitution, that expressly guarantees us the right to peaceably assemble, to petition our government for a redress of grievances, to be able to exercise our religion freely. So those right. things are guaranteed to us in both constitutions, and the state statute obviously violates that, at least in that sense. So it's very interesting that all these orders that he's trying to do, and the mask requirements and requirements for schools and all these other things, had absolutely nothing to do with what the law on the books actually says.
So. Right. So where, now that they've ruled on the 12th, where does it go from here?
Well, so an interesting thing is that I said a moment ago that the Supreme Court on the 12th had two orders. The other order that they had was that the given the results that came out of the other lawsuit that the legislature and I both got to participate as amicus, the legislature in their own lawsuit had filed a motion for immediate consideration of a peremptory reversal, saying that, you know, the lower courts got it so wrong. They said that the governor could continue doing what she's doing, that the laws were constitutional, that she was following the laws, no big deal. And so what the court said in this, and this was, this was a 4-3 decision mm-hmm. Of the court, but they said that the motion for peremptory reversal is considered on an immediate basis. And then they referred to the reasons stated in the other case with the doctor's offices, and that due to those, that motion is granted. And that means that they then, in fact, reversed the part of the judgment of the Court of Appeals holding that the governor possesses the authority to issue executive orders under the EPGA, that 1945 law. And as stated in that doctor's case, the Emergency Powers of Governor Act of 1945 is incompatible with the Constitution of our state and therefore executive orders issued under that act are of no continuing legal effect. So this order is effective upon entry, it said. So we don't have any more of the 21-day garbage that she tries to pull, saying her orders are still allowed. And that they're remanding the case to the trial level court for immediate entry of an order granting declaratory relief. The interesting thing, just as a side note, so someone who also watches my videos and is trying to, you know, keep up to date on all the law and the Constitution and trying to inform herself, she decided to write an email to the House Democratic leader, Christine Gregg. Mm-hmm. And so she wrote her an email, and yesterday on the 19th of October, the House Democratic leader wrote back and said that the governor's executive orders are still in effect, and it's only when she said when the order or the opinion from the court from the Michigan Supreme Court goes into effect, that's when we'll lose all these protections for unemployment and COVID restrictions and things like that. Now, keep in mind, that's on the 19th of October, whereas on the 12th, in two cases, they smacked down the governor's orders. And in this, they specifically said this order is effective upon entry. So this was a whole week prior to her sending that email out to a constituent, lying her butt off about the executive orders. So
this is why I think it's so important, of the many things you're doing which are important. One of the things that is so important is helping people who are not attorneys or not familiar with government process, what these different things mean and what the law says. Because with that information, they can be very powerful. But they need to know, you know, because it gets very complicated and very technical quickly. But if they have someone like you making it clear and explaining, they can be very, very powerful. I mean, I can't imagine, is there a reason why a business or a church in Michigan shouldn't be open for business?
Well, I could tell you that a church in Michigan should never have been closed ever.
I absolutely agree. Right.
We have a First Amendment right under our United States Constitution, and we have an Article 1, Section 4 right under our Michigan Constitution. In fact, I just want to share this with you because I believe in many ways our Michigan Constitution is much more specifically crafted to protect our rights than the United States Constitution. So our Michigan Constitution says, Article 1, by the way, this is our preamble to the state Constitution of Michigan. We, the people of the state of Michigan, grateful to Almighty God for the blessings of freedom and earnestly desiring to secure these blessings undiminished to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution. So all of the rights below, they're saying undiminished, guys, not that they can trample upon them or change them or infringe upon them in any way. Specifically, Article 1 of our state constitution is the Declaration of Rights. It's fabulous. 27 sections specifically devoted to our rights. Section 4 is called Freedom of Worship and Religious Belief. And it says that every person shall be at liberty to worship God according to the dictates of his own conscience. So if you want to worship God by having common fellowship with your neighbor, in the general sense of the term, you can do that. If you want to go to a Sunday service and not wear a mask and sit in the same pews that you've always sat in, next to the same people you've always sat next to, you can do that. Even if your church is a church that holds 500 or 1,000 people, you are welcome to do that. No governor, no Michigan Department of Health and Human Services director, no legislature has the right, no state Supreme Court or even the United States Supreme Court has the right to trample upon that right. So no church should have ever closed in terms of,
I agree with
on a legal basis. On a Christian basis, we're not given a spirit of fear. I believe it's 2 Timothy 1 through 7, maybe, tells us that we're not given a spirit of fear, but of power, of love, and of a sound mind. So we're supposed to use that sound mind to not live in fear, but live in faith and be able to understand where we need to do things and where we don't. And God always wants us to be able to worship him. So at any rate, as far as that question goes, nothing should ever stand in the way of a pastor or a congregation having service.
I have to tell you, there was one wonderful group. I forget what state it was, but the congregation decided it would have worship service in a parking lot or in the park. And the police came and tried to shut them down and say it was illegal. And they said, no, we're having a worship protest. And the police said, oh, okay, then it's okay.
Oh, my goodness.
Right, so they decided to call it a worship protest.
Oh, goodness.
Okay, so two more questions. I'm sure you've been very busy, but have you had time to look at what other states are doing and how they can benefit from understanding what's happening in Michigan?
I haven't had time, to look at what other states are doing, but what I can tell people is that the United States Constitution, Article 6, has a supremacy clause, and it says the United States Constitution is the supreme law of the land for every single state and territory here in the United States. So no matter who your governor is, or what your legislature is doing, or which president gets elected in November, that provision remains, and the United States Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and it's not what the Constitution as it's defined by the Michigan, by the United States Supreme Court over the last couple hundred years. It's what the law actually says in terms of what are the words actually written in the United States Constitution, and what did they mean back then? Right. Because that's the meaning that it means now. Also in the Article 6 of our United States Constitution is that oath of office. So every single state, it doesn't matter if you're in Louisiana or California or New York or Washington or, you know, any Oregon, any of these other places where we're having a lot of big issues in receiving national attention, every single executive, legislative, and judicial branch officer under Article 6 of our United States Constitution is required to take an oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution. So if their state constitution ever should transect the United States Constitution, that state constitution doesn't hold up. That doesn't, you can't take away any liberties guaranteed to us in our United States Constitution by somehow having a state constitution that somehow takes them away.
I used to be part of a group in Philadelphia that would take the U.S. Constitution and get a neighborhood to read it together and talk about what it meant about your responsibilities and obligations within your community. And yeah. It was like a constitutional covenant discussion for your neighborhood. And it was really remarkable because it's an amazing document. And, I think listening to you, one of the things that really inspired me that you did was, a radio commentator said, if you could talk to Governor Whitmer, what would you say? And you proceeded to talk about the oath of office she has taken and how it's real. And, we are in a society now where we have a group of people who think, oh, that's just the you say when you're getting your job or something, but it's not real. They don't understand. And so for the law to work, and I would say the entire economy to work and the civilization to work, it's got to be real. It's got to be, the law is a living, breathing thing. And, when you describe that, you really infuse the fact that she made a commitment, and that's a legal commitment to, and it's a covenant, it's a spiritual covenant, and it's real.
Yeah.
Right. And so she's going to get held accountable, but we all have a responsibility to understand that and be part of it. And if we will support it, we can, it's a very, very powerful thing. Yeah. I think the covenant, the spiritual covenant we have as a people with that constitution is very, very real. And it's the power we need now. Now, well, I have to say, to get that power, we need people like you explaining it to us.
Well, and so with that in mind, the Ninth Amendment of the United States Constitution is the same as the first Article 1, Section 23 of our state constitution. And I don't think I've gone over that yet here in this interview, have I?
No.
I just came off of another interview, so I want to make sure I wasn't mixing them up. But that's one of the most important. So we know that the 10th Amendment of the United States Constitution says that for any of the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or right. to the people. Right. And that's very important. But even more important than that, the people need to remember and to realize and memorize the Ninth Amendment. The enumeration in this Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So that goes back to God gave us all of these liberties, and the whole point of government is so that we can come together to live collectively as a society and have a system or a mechanism by which we can ensure that people are not going to infringe upon the rights of other people. So you can't go and murder someone and then not be held accountable for that. Right. There will be a government, a system in place to hold you accountable for doing so. And so the whole point is of this, the Ninth Amendment to the United States Constitution is underscoring the point that it is government that is limited by the Constitution. Government is limited by the Constitution and is expressly given only certain points of authority where they're allowed to act. If the Constitution does not give the government a point of authority to act in a certain way, that means they're acting unconstitutionally. They're right. acting outside of the bounds of their given authority.
Right.
And so that means the flip side of that is the people. The people are not given their rights by the government, by the governor, by the president, by the legislature, by the courts. The people are given their rights by God, and the people's rights, the whole point of the Constitution is to secure those blessings of freedom. And so the government and the whole makeup and framework for the government, state, federal, local, it doesn't matter. It's all there to protect those individual liberties. And right. so when government goes astray with that, then again, the government has done wrong, not the people. And so the people, when they have all these God-given liberties that are protected, this catch-all provision says, we don't need to list all of our freedoms because this document is not meant to box us in and carve out certain exceptions for us to be able to exercise liberty. The whole point is that No. We're limiting what the government can do.
Right.
And we're specifically identifying the obvious areas where people need to have special attention drawn to the rights that we have and that government cannot trample upon, but that we have all of the other rights still intact. And it's the government's job not only to not trample upon them, but to serve to protect them
right.
as the whole point of society in the first place. Right. So people need to remember that. Do you have a right to wear, not to wear a mask when you're in public? Yes, you do. Does right. it? Do we have to write inside of this document that we have the right to breathe fresh air? No, because it doesn't make sense. And we right. don't even have to wait for, hundreds of years of jurisprudence to come out from the United States Supreme Court to tell us, well, these unenumerated rights are this one and then this one and then this one. That's great if they want to talk about those by way of example, but that is no exhaustive list. If we were setting it up to have our state Supreme Court or United States Supreme Court or any other government branch or office create and write down this list for us, then we just would have done it ourselves in the Constitution. We specifically said there's this list that remains unlisted and we have those rights, and government, don't screw it up because you can't trample upon right. those.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, so how do we keep up with your work? How do we support you? We know you founded Restore Freedom. Tell us how we can help.
If anybody's in Michigan, I'm going to ask that you help us collect signatures. We need to get 425,059 signatures in short order here, about 4 weeks' time. We're asking for those signatures to be turned in. So that we can get on the November 2022 ballot and create history here. Because what we're trying to do is to strip away, we're not changing the form and structure of government with this petition. We are stripping away all the garbage that's been added and clarifying all the points of, quite frankly, the obvious points that our government hasn't been able to let sink into their thick skulls in all these processes. And so this stuff never happens again. And once we do it here in Michigan, that'll certainly pave the way for it to begin happening, and movements of grassroots people can start doing this in their states as well. So we need the help with that. If you're not here, or you're just not physically able to help us collect signatures, again, you don't have to be somebody that's at an event with thousands of people. You could be that person that throws a few empty petitions in the back seat on a clipboard. You get out of the car, you're looking at the filling up your tank at the gas station, look over, and the guy next to you is not wearing a mask. Right. That's going to be your clue that he might enjoy his freedom and fresh air, and he might be willing to sign that petition. So we need everyone to step forward with this. Obviously, donations help. As of today, my team's trying to figure out what the very little amount of funding that we do have. Are we going to be able to advertise on the radio these last few weeks? Are we going to be able to do some Facebook or Google ads? You know, what are we able to do to help get the message out there? And so the funding, but also there's the legal side of the work, right? All the briefs that I've been filing, there's always a court filing fee. Some of the courts, it's $150 each motion. Some of them, it's $75.
Right.
There's always, the cost of if I have to get printed documents, like from the court of claims, that stuff is not available online. So if a case happens against the legislature against the governor in the court of claims, and I want to try to participate in some way, I have to ask for paper copies of all the documents and pay for that.
Right.
And so that's usually a few hundred dollars. I'm going to need a new printer here completely in a little bit. I've already had multiple toners and drums and things.
Right.
The amount of costs in that sense are astronomical. And I am not taking on any new cases right now because I'm fighting for the people as a whole and in defense of our United States and Michigan Constitution. So my family's living off of donations basically right now.
If you come into Solari, we've started something. You'll see on the homepage, you'll see a man in a business suit with red gloves. It's called the Take Action Crowdfund. And it's there to support litigators who are fighting these fights. So we will send you a donation from the crowdfund, but we will also put it up on the crowdfund so we can direct people to your website. So,
yes, thank you.
And I'm hoping that when we publish this, this will also help.
And our website is restorefreedomkh.com. That's restorefreedom, K as in Catherine, H as in Henry.com.
Okay, kh.com. Okay, yeah. Great.
And our donation, we have a donation button that's on there. We also have ways to get involved for people that are, quite frankly, all across the world.
Okay. Okay, well, Catherine Henry, thank you for everything you've done, everything you're doing, everything I know you will do. It makes an enormous difference. So I hope your kids know how proud they should be of you.
The teenagers don't, but I think the six-year-old does.
Okay, you have a wonderful day. Thank you again.
Yes, thank you.